Those who can do, those who cannot do it on the internet. FancyPantsGangsters.com.
From theblogulator.com.
This is Blogulator Radio, fawning and skewering over all things television for the Fancy Pants Gangsters Network.
My name's Chris.
And I'm Jerksica.
And we're just a duo today. We've had a few past episodes.
Just the two of us.
With some
Daddy
combination.
Loves you. Daddy loves you.
Good reference, Jerksica. Good reference. We talked about Game of Thrones last week, me with Qualler and Bridget, and then the week before that, the four of us did a little bit on the upfronts. But it's just me and Jerksica this week to talk about the conclusion of Mad Men's Season 5.
Mm-hmm.
Qualler and Bridget aren't quite up to date on it.
No, they're working on it.
Yeah.
I'll be interested to hear
Definitely.
What they think. I think that Season 5, which just finished, is one of the best, if not the best seasons of Mad Men.
That's controversial opinion, according to
true.
The blogosphere, Twittersphere.
I'm standing by
it. Etc. Wow. Well, let's get into it. I mean, there's a lot of things to talk about, especially because, as I mentioned before we started recording, this is the first time we talked about the show since the premiere, which itself was kind of controversial in that some people didn't think much happened. Some people thought it was way too much.
These are
focus.
People that have seen Mad Men before and they didn't think much happened.
Right. And I think that part of the problem was that 16-month hiatus before it finally returned. And, you know, in retrospect, you think about Mad Men, you think about all the crazy stuff that's happened, but nobody seems to remember the fact that it takes a while. It's a slow burn show. And even with something like the premiere, which was 2 hours, you're not going to have much happen except just getting immersed in that world again. I think the biggest complaint regarding that was there was so much focus on Megan Draper, who by all accounts is a new main character for this season. And I mean, I didn't have some of the thoughts that people had regarding like her big intimate number musical number of Zooby Zoo.
Oh yes.
Or that final scene in the premiere where it's questionable about was Don Draper being aggressive sexually with his wife or was
he was being sexually aggressive. Was it
welcomed
or not?
Correct. Right. That's the real question. But those
in
things
in this shades of gray era.
You and your references. But I think most people just like didn't want to 4 seasons later invest themselves in a character that by all accounts of the first few episodes didn't really seem to have a lot of faults or flaws.
Well, I disagree a little bit though, because I think towards the end of the 5th season it really became about Megan as a main character, but I think the first half of the season was really Megan as a vehicle for explaining Don's evolution and where he is now.
Yeah.
So I think it was much less like I didn't feel like I needed to invest in her as a character as much as just kind of watch how Don's new character had developed over time.
Right. And because Weiner and the Mad Men writers decided to fast forward between season 4 and 5 to after their wedding, after they've kind of gotten comfortable living together in this swanky Manhattan apartment, it was definitely kind of like a blank slate start over, very similar to how season 4 was a blank slate start over for the agency side of the show.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the best thing that Mad Men does just overall, not just with season 5, is that it circumvents expectations of the viewer, even when the viewer like really thinks that what they want to expect is what they want. I mean, that's the whole theme of specifically season 5 is sometimes you get what you want, but it ends up not satisfying you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even with the
Hello
most
finale.
Ardent, yeah, with even the most ardent fans, that theme was sometimes beat over the head a little bit. That seems to be the main controversy, other than Megan Draper's newfound main characterdom, is that season 5 was all about hitting you over the head with oblique, overt symbolism.
I think that, I think that there's some truth in that criticism, but I also think this season set up a lot of things for season 6 and 7.
Which will definitely be the last two of the show. Yeah.
Right, but like as a teaser, like there were a lot of things in this season that I thought he was setting up so well that I thought that he was going to blow his wad on this season, and he didn't.
What do you mean,
blow
his wad?
They're like holding on to it.
You mean like cheat on? go back to original Don Draper mode? Is that
No, I think that's something that they've sort of hinted at in the finale.
Especially in the last scene of
the
finale.
Right, but I mean, like, that's an example of that. Like, a lot of the season was setting up the dynamics of the of Don Draper's new marriage and whether or not he's truly turned over a new leaf or if, you know, he's just Don Draper with a new wife.
Right.
They set a lot of things up with Sally, who this season is really, you know, starting to be a teenager, and
she gets her own kind of coming of age story,
right? Mm-hmm. And rebel in ways that I think are going to make really interesting storylines. Betty Draper and her crumbling new marriage, and
who only appeared in I think 3 episodes of the 13,
and the whole weight gain controversy and what that's going to mean and how that's going to play out. I think those are 3 examples of plot lines where Wiener spent like episodes and episodes and episodes setting those up and never knocked the pins over this season. Like, left them sitting there for us to sort of watch. I love that. I think it's
fantastic. So much
so
that you think it's one of the best seasons, if not the
best. I do, because and here's why I think it is one of the best seasons. Because there were so many things that had to happen in terms of, like, just straight plot points to get us to this point. You know, the fact that they started their own agency. and what that meant for the power dynamics in the offices. The end of his marriage to Betty, the introduction of Megan. I mean, all of those things had to happen in the previous seasons for you to truly understand the characters. Uh-huh. And I think that's what Matthew Weiner does so well, is setting up these really, really complex characters over time. And that's why we call it a slow burn, and that's why sometimes it feels like maybe nothing's happening. But I feel like season 5, like, when you opened on this season, you finally had so much backstory for all of the characters that when they did all, like, the kind of parody tropes of the show where they say vague things and they slam a door or they just, like, stare at each other over a cigarette.
You're referencing specifically the next week on Mad Men.
Right, but I mean, but those are real scenes. I mean, those are real things that happen. And I think you understand them a lot better in the context of this season because you've had 5 seasons leading up to it, or 4 seasons leading up to
it. See, what it seems, sounds like you're implying is that a lot of the subtleties and vagaries of the show have come more alive and become more oblique because we've spent 4 seasons with them, not necessarily because of the choices of, for instance, Don's toothache or Don drawing a noose in the margins of his notepad. Those kinds of things that are in and of themselves without any backstory. Like, somebody could come into Mad Men season 5 and never seeing the show before and be like, oh, duh, he's having a toothache because he feels guilty.
Right, and I don't think you understand it as well. And I think that's why maybe some people see it as, like, way too heavy-handed in terms of symbolism, because I think there's still a lot of subtlety that's happening around those things, those components.
So I think I can get on board with you.
And here's the other reason I think it's so good, is because of all of that, if you're on board with that, going into season 6, I think of the characters totally differently than I did before season 5. Like, Don's not the same Don that existed at the end of season 4.
You don't think that's what the final scene of the finale suggests?
I mean, that's what we talked about, inferring that he's going to go back to his, like, old, womanizing ways. But whether he does that or not, I feel like he has had a different perspective as Don Draper than he did in seasons before.
So,
you know, his marriage might change, right? Or right. Or not change. The way he deals with women may not change. But, I mean, he's certainly approaching his work a lot differently. The guilt that he's had over various aspects of his life continues to deepen.
Let's go through these one at a time. Since Don Draper is the main character, and maybe we can talk more specifically about some of the things that result in these, you think, changes, but you also admit that they also could be viewed as reversions back to his original self, yes? No? You don't think so? You don't think it's open to interpretation like that?
Can you truly ever go back? I mean, that's what I'm saying, though. I think he might take on some of his old behaviors, right? Or be dealing with similar themes that he's been dealing with, but it's in a much more, like, there are new dimensions to it now than there were before.
So, and I'm just playing devil's advocate, because I honestly don't know how much I feel like this. I feel, so here's been my usual, as some, I think USA Today claimed him, super viewer habits, is that you watch a show, you tweet about it, and you also read reviews about it.
You can proclaim oneself a super viewer.
Yeah, why not?
All right.
But what I tended to do was just read about the show through Alan Sepinwall, who has a very unique style of reviewing in which he doesn't necessarily be very defensive or be very offensive about his views, whereas TV critic Mo Ryan for Huffington Post, who I've been reading this season, has had a very negative, very directly skewering view of Mad Men Season 5, in which she talks about how every decision that a character makes, either she doesn't find realistic or she finds kind of absurd to the point of going back to the heavy-handedness of the symbolism, or basically just making the show go in a direction that doesn't make you want to follow the characters' lives anymore. And here's the question that comes into play with, for instance, Don Draper, is that he comes to the end of the finale and he's had recycling in his life of many different kinds, whether it be temptations to cheat on his wife, causing somebody inadvertently, or you could argue subconsciously, to commit suicide, and struggling with the idea of having control in the workplace versus being uninspired in the workplace. These are all things that we've seen over and over again, both throughout season five and previous seasons. Do you think that that necessarily makes for legitimate change in a character that makes us want to continue following them for two more seasons?
Well, I, of course I'm going to say yes.
But explain why.
Because I feel like those themes, although they're recycled, are not, like, it's not, I wouldn't necessarily say it's recycled. It's they're continuing themes in his life that he's dealing with in different ways. And he's making choices thinking that he's escaping that, or he's becoming a new person. And then it's really, is he becoming a new person, or is he, you know, continuing to obsess about, you know, guilt in his past and his control issues and his own self-destruction. And I think that's what's so interesting is, you know, at least with Don, is watching his self-destructive behavior juxtaposed against the level of control and professional success that he has.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's just the same thing over and over again. How this season points to, he does start cheating on his wife again, I think that that's going to... he's going to think about that, or he's going to feel about that much differently than he did before. And it's going to be that much more of a failing. He's going to have that much more guilt over it. And I think that's going to force him to act out professionally in different ways
too. So, okay, let's break this down based on what's happened in the past 13 episodes. An example of that, the most obvious one that comes to mind, is when he does think that he has cheated on his wife during a fever dream in which he imagines Madchen of Mick.
Yeah.
Appearing in his bedroom, and he has to give in to her this temptation. And
he keeps saying no, and she just keeps coming back.
Right.
And then he murders her.
And then he murders her, supposedly, probably because of the guilt that he has over it, and because of this relentless temptation that he feels is no longer something that he can control.
Mm-hmm.
And
choking, I think, which is an interesting choice,
sure,
too.
Yeah.
He didn't take out a gun and shoot her in the face.
Yeah,
you know?
Okay, so former women's studies major.
Well, no, I mean...
No, you're totally right, though.
And that's what some people might say, is, oh, yeah, God, we get it, it's a little heavy-handed.
Yeah.
But you loved that episode. That was your favorite episode.
Okay, so now you're pointing out that maybe I'm just playing devil's advocate here, which is probably true, because I mean, I'm going to watch the hell out of Mad Men Season 6 and 7. Anyways.
You don't have the heavy-handedness. What are you left with except the next on blank stares and...
So do you... Would you be mad?
Meaningful looks.
Would you be upset that if Mad Men Season 6 and 7 started being more subtle again? Like, do you feel like you really like the heavy-handedness?
No, I think that this season did a really good job of balancing both.
So you...
I think there was still a lot of subtlety in the season. And I will disagree with the blogosphere about that. And maybe it helps that, like, I think my opinions are valid and no one else's are. So maybe I have thicker skin that way. But I feel like there was a good balance in the act. Because I think you need some heavy-handedness, because you need to have those moments of, like, holy shit, like, during the season when you're watching.
Well,
and you don't get that unless they, you know... They have his, you know, his dead brother appear, or they have, you know.
It's a different, well, okay, here's the example for the finale. I think this is probably a key point to Don Draper's character that we need to talk about is both the suicide of Lane Price and how that recalled the suicide of Don Draper, a.k.a. Dick Whitman's brother, Adam. So he came back, and we missed this, and actually Seppenwald's review of the finale keyed me off to this, was that as he walks through the halls of the office at the beginning of the finale episode, he looks and sees who apparently Adam to mm-hmm. him in one of the other cubicles, kind of looking as he's typing on a typewriter, I think. Mm-hmm. And you and I didn't catch that right away. We were just like, why is he looking like that? And then we figured out in the next scene that they were talking about moving, getting more space upstairs.
Right, so we thought that that's what that scene
right.
was about.
Because there was other people in the right. room and him thinking possibly, right. you know, oh, it's so cramped in here, everybody needs a new office. But what turns out is that that was, you know, Adam showing up to remind him of the connection between Lane Price's suicide, mm-hmm. especially because that happened in the office.
I think Don Draper should, if he's going to make a habit out of, like, talking people into killing themselves, that he should at least have them take out life insurance policies first. But interestingly enough, they did have a life insurance right. policy on behalf of the partner. So, you know, good for Don.
Yeah, exactly.
If you're gonna push someone to end
which
it
just
all.
Is like, and that comes, I've been waiting to make this comment, but that's a perfect example. That scene between him and Mrs. Price.
Okay.
Exemplifies something that I wonder if some people are missing out on, is the absolute hilarious dark comedy of this show.
Right.
And it's always been good at this, but I think maybe that's what's been more subtle this season, is that a lot of people see the heavy-handedness as beating it over the head like ninth grade English class, whereas I kind of saw a lot of it and I reacted positively to things like Don drawing a noose in the margins of his right. notepad during a boring business meeting as hilarious.
Right.
Because, yeah, it has that deep connection to, you know, a theme or message or whatever, character analysis. But it also is just straight up funny that these characters who we've gotten to know all have senses of humor, which, you know, any proper human being does. And therefore, when these things happen, it can be funny that we're in on something that they're not, because they're just doodling or because he just has a toothache. And that's Don's mentality, just to hope things go away.
Right.
And that's why I've liked some of the heavy-handedness.
Because they're so far away from self-awareness.
Exactly.
That the viewer gets to watch that from the outside.
And you can make the argument that that's unrealistic, but I also don't think that it is, considering yeah. the fact that we have 50 years of history on these characters, and they're placed in that time period in which maybe they're all self-obsessed.
Well, I was going to say, you think it's unrealistic because, like, in reality, all of us, like, we're so self-actualized. Like, we're so, you know, operating on all cylinders all the time, completely in tune with our bodies and our emotions and our
I think that's
psyches.
That's the illusion that we like to make as viewers mm-hmm. during television, especially okay. heavy dramas like Mad Men. You're making fun of me.
No, I'm not. No, I'm making fun of people that would criticize that.
Yeah.
Would point to that reason that the show is too heavy-handed or unrealistic.
Right. Especially because
I have lots of other things to make fun of you for. I don't know, just stoop to that.
Especially because, I mean, when we noticed this last night with the scene that a lot of people were talking about on Twitter that recalled the season one finale, where Don is just leaning back in his chair smoking a cigarette and the smoke filters in with the light coming from the projection. Mm-hmm. And this time he was looking at the screen test of his wife, and in season one he was looking at childhood mm-hmm. pictures
oh, that's
of,
right.
of his kids with Betty right before his big carousel pitch for Kodak. And so
I forgot about that.
The parallel of that is one of the nice subtleties that they still do on the show that I don't think is necessarily so obvious that, you know, is clued in right away. But we noted that while we were watching, like, wow, that's a really cool shot. It probably was a really cool shot to us, not only because aesthetically it looked cool, but because it recalled
yeah.
nostalgically, which is fitting because of what Don's speech mm-hmm. was about Carousel, that very first season finale. So I think that the idea of things being recycled isn't necessarily a bad one, especially because of what you said, is even though he's doing the exact same thing now, it's in a completely different state of mind, emotionally, mentally, than what we knew him as in season one.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if he tries, especially with Don, if he's like trying to be a better person and he feels like he's failed at that, I think that's going to be an intensely more difficult failure for him to grapple with than
right.
in previous seasons.
Okay, so I'll take the opportunity to bring up one last criticism that people have been saying of this season.
Is
that
bring it?
It's just it's fucking depressing.
Well, yeah, but it's also funny, like you pointed out. Right. I think there's a lot of comedy in this season. But
can you have the dark comedy, especially because dark comedy, I think, is a genre that specifically applies to film, which is a, you know, a one shot deal where you get a story beginning end, you're done with it.
Really?
No, you don't think so?
No, I think they're examples. I think they're few and far between, but I think they're examples of television series that handle dark comedy really well.
Yeah, I think so too. But stay with me here.
Okay.
In that television, it's a lot harder to pull off.
It is.
Because you're following these characters for so long throughout the course of a season, and also the course of a series.
And if you have a 16-month hiatus between seasons, I think it makes it that much more difficult.
Yeah. And especially when...
It's like you're waiting for your prom date to show up. They're 2 hours late, and then they bring you a fucking carnation, you know?
That would be hilarious,
right.
But also depressing.
Right.
So I think a lot of people have struggled with that idea that... We've been following characters that were stuck in the 50s, and we're only getting further and further into the future.
Right.
So, of course, it's not going to get prettier. It's probably going to get more dour, but there's got to be some kind of... What's the motivation behind us watching this if we know the outcome for Don Draper at all is going to be depressing? Is it just the comedy? Is that enough to be able to laugh once a week for the next... 2 years.
Well, I can answer this question, but I think that that's a better question for you, and you clearly have an opinion on it, because I think of all people, you purposefully pick out the most depressing shit to watch. Always.
Well, that's an interesting question. You hate when I pick out depressing, like, indie dramas to watch on Netflix.
Because I think it's the opposite of what you said, is that, yes, it's easier to infuse, like, black comedy, you know, into a movie when it's a two-hour block. Mm-hmm. But I also don't have 4 seasons to develop any kind of affinity for the characters. So I know going in when the credits roll that, oh, God, this is depressing, and I know what the plot is, and it's horrifying.
Yeah.
But I don't know what the plot of Mad Men is, and I don't know ultimately how I would describe the plot of Mad Men, you know, after the 7th season is up. And I do have a love for these characters.
Right.
So I do care what happens to them.
So describe, for instance, your love for Don Draper. And we'll talk about other characters other than Don as we move on from this, hopefully soon. But describe for me your love for Don Draper, especially after, as you said, he's gotten through this season, his first season where he's retained fidelity to his wife for 13 episodes, and yet we end going into a new season with the possibility of yet again him... Oh, he also killed some, you know, indirectly... help somebody commit suicide, and
two people,
and now we're going into another season, and also he's a questionable father,
right?
And now we're going into a new season, and he's probably going to cheat on his wife again,
right? Well, I don't think Don's the only example of this. I think you could say that for all the characters on the show.
Let's start with Don.
But that's what I'm saying, though. They're all flawed human beings that are trying to do good. I don't think there's anyone on that show that has poor intentions, including Pete Campbell, who I think is the skeeziest of the skeezes.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that continual struggle and juxtaposition between their want to be successful and to be good people and their failings is what makes it so interesting to watch, because I think that that's a parallel to our own lives.
You lump those two things together as if they can be lumped together, to be successful and to be a good person. I don't argue with you that Don wants to be successful. Do you really think that Don wants to be a good person?
I think that that's what they've played out, you know, in showing him want to reconnect with his children more this season. I think you saw his children more this season together with him than you ever did.
Which is ironic considering their divorce.
Right. Mm-hmm. With his marriage with Megan. I think when they got the new agency and what he wanted to do, you know, what he wanted to go forward with, and how they wanted to present themselves as a new agency... when he thinks he's being a good mentor to Peggy, or a good mentor to other people in the office.
Yeah, that's a very problematic relationship.
Right, but I mean, his intentions, I think he wants to be a good person. I don't think he knows what that means, and I don't think there are any examples around him.
I think he has a huge double standard in that maybe he wants to be good to Peggy, he wants to be good to Megan, but he wants that to eventually reflect back on himself and him feeling good about himself.
But that's what all of us want,
sure.
Right?
Yeah, you can make that argument.
That's what I find interesting.
Okay. So let's break it down with other characters then. Let's talk about Peggy, since she probably had the second biggest change as far as main characters go, in that she departed ways with Don Draper.
I think her character shifted a lot too, because when the series started, she was like all up and coming and like the young one, right?
Mm. She was the Nick Carraway to Don Draper's Gatsby.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And now she's becoming more and more Gatsby-like.
Yeah.
You know, like, she's also coming into her own. I would say she's peaking professionally right now, which is why she was able to. She had all of these advocates and all of this huge support system to move on and take on a role at a new agency. So she's peaking professionally, but at the same time, you have people like Ginsberg, right, that are coming in after her that are really representing, you know, what's the youth culture of the 1960s about, mm-hmm. and how does that play out in the advertising realm.
Right. So, well, I mean, that's interesting you mentioned that, because a lot of people have kind of pointed out that Peggy's departure is a big symbol for the progression of the era, especially with women's rights and what she's mm-hmm. trying to do as far as individualizing herself away from the agency that, you know, for better or worse, I mean, for how Don phrases it or not, helped her get to the point where now she can take a nice offer from another agency and justify moving on from them.
Mm.
So what do you think is difference between her quote-unquote generation, not necessarily age-wise, but perspective-wise for the show, versus Ginsberg's? Isn't that what Ginsberg is looking to do too? Just up and come and then move on and become as successful?
This is like Chris asks Jessica heated questions for half an hour, but I like it.
You're handling them very well.
No, I think the difference is, well, and this is another thing I find so interesting, right? That you know, Peggy was successful coming in and fighting against, obviously, a lot of the gendered politics of the workplace, mm-hmm. right? But Don was never jealous of Peggy, right? Don never tried to steal one of Peggy's ideas is his own.
Good point.
You know, he took credit for things because that's who Don is. He takes credit for everyone's. But he's jealous of Ginsberg.
Yeah.
And they frame Ginsberg as just being a genius copywriter. Is he that much better than Peggy? Or is what's interesting the fact that, you know, even though Ginsberg might represent a new era in terms of political perspective and cultural perspective, that he's still recycling the same gendered bullshit that Peggy was fighting against. You know, it's like
right.
it's like Peggy punches a hole in the glass ceiling and Ginsberg's there to, you know, piece it back together in right. a way.
Which is another darkly comic moment is the fact that Peggy helped get Ginsberg hired.
Right. But
she's the one that found him.
And during that interview, you know, he wasn't really taking her very seriously, which was,
right.
you know, they had that whole comedic exchange, mm-hmm. the interview process. But ultimately, that's an example of, you know, Don giving Peggy some power to interview, but not to make an ultimate decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, I wouldn't say that Ginsberg is any less sexist than Don is, or Roger is, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
It's just packaged differently.
Right, right.
Which is a criticism, I think, of the whole counterculture, the hippie counterculture of the 60s. Anyway, right?
Do you think Ginsberg represents that?
Well, not so much in that, you know, he's not a hippie, right? He's working right. for the man, but they brought him in because he's good at advertising to everyone, including you know, the youth, including the counterculture. And I think that that's going to become more and more of a theme on the show.
Right.
Is how those politics are affecting it. And I think there's a parallel there between the criticisms that counterculture got within third wave feminism, saying, yeah, you know, yes, you're fighting against the man, right? You're fighting against this capitalist construct in society, but ultimately you're still misogynist, and ultimately you're still you know, racist. And
well,
I think that plays out in Ginsberg.
And the race thing is something that was hinted at early on in the season with the hiring of Don, D-A-W-N, Don's
right.
secretary.
Right.
Also a nice comedic touch.
Good morning, Don. Don.
But, and that's something that you could also argue, talking about Peggy as, and Ginsberg as these people that might have like a some kind of grasp on the counterculture, but don't necessarily fit into it all the way. You also had in previous seasons Peggy go on with the life photographer played by Zosia Mamet and her boyfriend, who's the kind of revolutionary photographer kind of guy.
Well, and way back, I think in season one, with Don dating that the beatnik.
Yep. You could go back to that too.
Roger doing LSD.
Yeah. So, and that's what I want to talk about. The stuff happening this season is you've got Roger on LSD. You've got Don and Harry going to the Rolling Stones concert.
Yes.
I think it was one of my favorite scenes of the season.
Right.
And then you've got Ginsberg. The interesting thing about him is that, like you said, he knows how to market to anybody, including the counterculture. Mm-hmm. But that really kind of weird yet touching scene where we find out who Ginsberg is.
Yeah, that was, I think that was one of my favorite scenes of the whole.
Which one are you talking about? Because I'm thinking of two. There's the one where he
talks about being an alien.
Okay, yeah. There's that one, but there's also the scene where he goes back to his father.
Yes.
And it turns out that he's just like kind of an ostracized son figure of this devout Jewish guy. And when you look at that through that lens as just him as also this
and as caretaker to an ailing parent.
Yeah, this terrifying perspective that he has in his personal life, combined with the alien story that was kind of stand-in for what we can only assume to be the truth that he was born during the Holocaust in a concentration camp, that it kind of throws this whole idea of the counterculture almost out the window of from, I feel like, Mad Men's perspective, because we've seen somebody like Don Draper, who totally reinvented himself from a farm boy, son of a whore, to becoming, you know, an exec at a very successful ad agency. And we've got Ginsberg, like somebody that, you know, I don't think it's a mistake that his last name is frickin' Ginsberg.
Right, right.
You know, Allen Ginsberg was kind of the poster child for the anti-establishment. Right. And also as part of the Jewish culture as folding into the counterculture of the 1960s, early 70s. And but we find out that he's not that guy.
Right.
He has that connection. He knows how to work it. Just like the whole point of advertising is to know it, not be it. He doesn't really fit in, though, just like none of the other characters who work at Stanley Draper.
Right, but I think that's another example of how the show's individual characters are reflecting that overall theme of, you know, the failings of human nature and the failings of humankind, and that we're, we evolve as a society, but we continue to recycle a lot of the same societal constructs that cause us problems.
Yeah, well, you talk about our baby's making noises. He's sick of us talking esoterically, I think. The biggest problem, quote-unquote, you mentioned the reflection of gender in the workplace is, I think, the big bombshell of the season, the water cooler moment that we have yet to talk about, is regards to Joan's character.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you phrase it that way, because although I think that's true, a season where someone hangs themselves in the office, and that's not the water cooler moment.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So
that's very telling, especially because that happened the episode directly after.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and also because Joan and Lane had their own dynamic throughout the season, that also resulted, I think, in a very strange and almost disconcerting line of dialogue by Joan in the finale, in which she says, "I should have just given him what he wanted."
Right.
But let's talk about it. So episode 10 of the season, I think? 11. Episode 11, The Other Woman.
Right.
Which I deem to be the episode of the month for theblogulator.com for May of 2012. Not because I necessarily liked it, but because it was just such a big moment that people are going to be talking about it in the scheme of Mad Men as a series for years to come.
All right.
Joan is...
Quit stringing him along.
Joan decides to sleep with a Jaguar executive in exchange for becoming a partner of the firm so that the firm can get the Jaguar account. And the biggest controversy behind this, not other than the obviousness of... her basically exchanging sex for money, but that people wondered, you know, is this something that A, Joan would do, and B, the men of the firm would be supportive of, aside from Don Draper, who was the one character to say, no, Joan, don't do it.
Yeah, well, and I think that's another example of Don trying to be a good person, but not truly understanding what it means to be a good person.
Right. And I present you with the theory that possibly John made that speech to Joan because he wanted to believe that his pitch itself could win them the account rather than some skeevy backdoor deal.
Right. And part of it is also, you know, paternalistic and control and, you know, needing to protect Joan from the scary world.
Right.
Which just increases, like, your level of disdain for Don in a
which
way,
is,
too.
Which is very problematic for me as a viewer, because another one of my favorite scenes of the season was when him and Joan just hung out at the bar together.
Right.
And they, I mean, these are two people that, yeah, there's probably some sexual tension because they're two very attractive people that know each other very well.
Right.
But at the same time, it's a platonic relationship, and they truly do just respect and admire each other, even as they probably also find each other attractive.
Mm-mm.
So seeing that, and it's kind of very threadbare, just very kind of like a hangout show moment for a series that is very much about characters scheming and doing backdoor deals, that was refreshing to me. And to see that result in an episode where the Joan-Don dynamic became a lot less honest and genuine, then it was frustrating for me, which I guess is part of the point, but doesn't change the fact that it was frustrating.
Right.
So what did you think about, I don't think I really heard from you about whether or not you think it was a realistic plot point for the series.
Well, I think you posed two questions. One, is it realistic for the character of Joan to have done that? And two, is it realistic that all the men in the office would talk about it? And I think to your first question about Joan, I kind of wavered on, but in thinking about it a lot more, I'd say a resounding yes. Because, again, because you've had four seasons of understanding Joan's character and getting to know her and realizing the situation that she's in, right? So she has a baby, and there's been a lot of upheaval at the firm. She really took a huge risk in going with the new firm in the first place. She took maternity leave and was worried about what was going to happen to her job when she got back, and her status in the office and her clout in the office. She kicked her husband out. You know, she doesn't have a whole lot of help for raising the kid. And people objectify her anyway. And people have sexually objectified her since the beginning of the series. I don't necessarily know if I'd characterize it as being exploited, because I think Joan's had a lot of control over that. But in some ways, the control that she's exerted has really just been a low level of control that society allows her to have, right? Like, she can only be assertive, and she can only be controlling within her own sexuality, which is already defined by how the men are objectifying her. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I think she's already living in this world where she is a sexual object to people, right? She has all of these financial concerns that she now has to grapple with, and she's had a lot of instability within the firm itself. And so if people are going to objectify her anyway, they're going to offer her a partnership. That means stability, it means control, it means more respect professionally.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't she do that?
I think there's also a significance between when Pete propositioned her and then a few scenes later, Lane did. Pete propositioned her to straight, basically, sex for money exchange,
right.
Whereas Lane, even though he's got his own flaws and faults, clearly, since he ended up committing suicide, which may or may not have some kind of connection with what happens in this episode, is that he thinks it through a little bit more and thinks, like, what does Joan actually care about? And he realizes that as office manager, as especially also someone that has experienced some clear sexual objectification in the office, he thinks, well, she might want go for this more if I offer her something that is more authoritative, because she's an authoritative person.
See, I read that differently.
Okay, what do you read it as?
I read that as one, I think when Pete propositions her, it's like, you, this is disgusting, Pete's a skeezy person anyway.
Yeah.
And I'm writing it off because he's such a lowlife, right? And then when Price comes, first of all, like, he thinks he's doing something great by thinking about, what does Joan want? I'm going to tell her not to sell herself short and she should go for a partnership. Mm-hmm. But I think that's very paternalistic, too, thinking that he knows, you know, what she wants or what she needs. And when he propositions her, you have somebody that Joan has more respect for, right, as an individual.
Which is...
coming to her with this disgusting, I think she sees it as disgusting, request. But it's not only just him. He's representative of all of the partners.
Right, and she does...
including the father of her child.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So she's getting the message from Price, from an individual she respects, that other people that she has some respect for, and she thought respected her, have no problem with having her be this sexual object in order to promote the strength of the firm.
My question for you is... and maybe I missed something, or maybe it's just based on first impressions and surface level impressions. Why does Joan respect Lane more than any of the other partners? Especially when in the episode Signal 30, when Lane punched Pete in the face.
Right.
I mean, maybe that's a reason to respect him, but you know, 2 seconds later, he's in Joan's office trying to make advances towards her.
Right.
So why does she still respect him after that?
I don't think that she has more respect for him than for others in the office. I think she has no respect for Pete, nor should she. Right? But I think she does have a certain level of respect for Lane, and I think you see that in previous episodes. For example, when she's still on maternity leave and she comes into the office, he's the one that she confides in, right? About...
oh, that's true.
About feeling feeling unsure about coming back to work, about whether or not her job's still going to be there waiting for her.
Yeah.
Interestingly, in that scene, he makes an advance on her, tries to kiss her, right? Or he does kiss her?
In that scene?
Isn't it that
it was
scene?
No, he tried to kiss her in the scene where... after he fights Pete.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
But, every scene that you've had with Lane and Joan, even though they're few and far between, he's definitely flirted with
her. And I think, she sees him as a weak person, right? I don't think she necessarily has, this... you know, she's not in, awe of his professional prowess or, who he is as a man.
So it's almost more of a pitying than a...
I think there's a little bit of pity there, but I also think generally she feels like he's given her some respect because his advances haven't been... it's gross, right?
True. And he is immediately sorry and embarrassed after...
yeah, his advances are somehow different. I don't know. But I just think, you know, the fact that proposition first came from Pete Campbell, I'd have the same,
Oh, yeah, of course. And the final thing, like you mentioned, is that Roger, of all people, somebody that I think for the longest time in this series, at least explicitly, has thought Joan, is a capable woman and is has probably given her more respect than anybody else, even though he's also used her as a mistress.
Yeah, but what's interesting is that he didn't immediately say, yes, this is good for the firm, we should do it. Initially he was disgusted by it, and then Pete was, lying, saying, well, she was open to it. She likes the idea. And then Roger asks, he repeats it back, she was open to this idea, right? And I think, in a way, I almost respect Roger in this context more than I do Don. Because you're right, if Roger looks at Joan with respect, right, and thinks that she's a capable woman, he says, this is what she wants to do, she has agency, she's making this decision, then I'm not going to stand in the way of it, I guess it's good for
everybody.
He's not
going to be paternalistic.
In a way, he's doing better by Joan, or doing better by Joan based on the information he has,
right,
than Don is. Who's just straight up
you could also look at
this is unethical.
Don's move of just leaving the office during the discussion as childish, and he kind of not necessarily deserves, but he should not think that it's that surprising that once he leaves a controversial conversation, especially one that Pete Campbell is leading,
right,
that something bad's going to go down.
I would leave Pete Campbell in a room alone with my sandwich, less any kind of business decision.
Yeah. Let's talk about Pete, since he had his own separate storyline for the season in that he officially cheated on Trudy. why you would cheat on Alison Brie is beyond comprehension for most straight males, but he does, and with Rory Gilmore, no less. Alexis Bledel cameos.
And whores. And all kinds of people.
The whorehouse. Who could forget the whorehouse? That's actually an interesting scene. We're talking about the oblique, heavy-handed symbolism, is that the prostitute goes through the different roles that she could play for him.
Right.
And he doesn't like any of them until she says, "You can be my king, I'll worship you."
Right.
Which is so obvious for somebody like Pete.
Right.
But the storyline with Rory Gilmore came to a head last night, in which...
Ha!
In which we find out that she is being sent to a mental hospital for electroshock therapy by her husband, Howard, who is Pete's kind of daily acquaintance on the train from the suburbs into the city. Fellow commuter. And we got to see the punch in the face of Pete for a second time this season, even though we went through four seasons of not seeing Pete getting little of any comeuppance. But it's in a moment.
Wasn't it satisfying?
But it was very satisfying when Lane punched him. The question is...
It is always satisfying to see Pete Campbell get punched in the face.
The question is, do you think it was effective?
I want Sally to punch him in the face. How satisfying would that be to get punched in the face by a little girl? Bam! He'd cry like a baby, too.
And you implied this earlier. Do you think that Pete was given a fair shake as a guy trying to do good when he confronted Howard about not caring about his wife and getting drunk and sending her to a mental hospital?
I don't think that was his intention. I mean, he probably thought he was trying to do good by protecting her, but really, wasn't he just upset that, you know, if he wants to be worshipped as somebody's king, isn't he just upset that he's so forgettable that, you know...
Because after the electroshock therapy...
His mistress doesn't even know who he is. Or recognize that she knows him.
He visits her and she thinks that he's some random guy that got in the wrong room.
So it's really just about he's no longer...
That goes back recognized. To the question, though. Same thing with Don Draper. Can you really legitimately sympathize with this person as a protagonist or with Pete Campbell as, you know, a subsidiary character and want to follow their story... When everything that they do, even when it's with quote-unquote good intentions, it's only because they want themselves to feel good? Are we supposed to just follow that because it's an inherently human trait, regardless of how depressing that fact is?
No, it's depressing, but it's also complex and it's interesting. If I want to watch people who have truly good intentions, Netflix all seasons of Touched by an Angel or some shit.
Speaking of, Netflix is our sponsor of the Blogulator's Blogulator Radio podcast.
I don't actually know if Touched by an Angel's on there, but...
You can figure it out. There's a lot of good shows and movies available on Netflix. You can go to bit.ly/blogflix for a free 2-week trial courtesy of Blogulator Radio and the Fancy Pants Gangsters Netcast Network. Or you can click on the link right there on the screen of where you're listening to this podcast, or go to fancypantsgangsters.com/bradio for more information. Back to the show, Mad Men.
Well, that's what I'm saying, though, is like good people, watching good people is boring. That's not good television.
Right. And I think the thing that everybody can agree with, even through season 5, is that while Pete Campbell is a horrible person and we... feelings when we see him on screen. You've got to admit that both he's written in, like you said, a complex way that makes a horrible person somehow have various shades and levels to them that you're constantly surprised by.
Shades of smugness.
Yeah. You're constantly surprised by how magnetic it is, but also just Vincent Kartheiser is really good at playing the skeeviest guy on television. So I think on that level, it succeeded. I actually did enjoy the scene where he first does give in and sleep with Rory Gilmore, where I forget if it's him or her that talks about the first pictures of Earth that have been released to the public.
And she is.
She does. And the
incident. And then he brings it up later to somebody else.
Right, because he found it poetic, but he brings it up later to somebody else and they don't give a shit.
Well, and he's not nearly as poetic about it.
Right, exactly. So when you see Pete actually have that kind of connection, I guess, even though it's a skeevy connection, even though it's still adultery, it's still kind of him being an awful person, you notice that whether or not he deserves it, Pete is thinking about his own humanity in a way that probably a lot of people do, even if they don't follow in on the impulses that that Pete does.
No, that's true. I will say this about Pete Campbell, though. He gives some really good comedic moments. Not just the punch in the face, but his character has been really hilarious to me this season. There's the whole, you know, relationship between him and Roger, like him wanting to like put Roger in his place and say, like, you know, like the student has become the master and you will worship me, you know, like his gleeful face when he's taking those stupid skis from one of the clients. the finale when they're going to look at what's going to be the new space of the office, and him saying like, Don, I'm going to have the same view as you. Like
John Hamm's face after he says that is hilarious.
I forget his little one-liner after that, too. It was pretty good.
Like, did he say something?
He said, like, so you will, or, like, good for you, or, like, something really patronizing. It was awesome.
Yeah. That shot, by the way, of the five of them, the five partners, sans Elaine, looking out the window in this really empty office space, which is essentially the exact same office space as what's below.
Mm-hmm.
But... you know, without any of the trappings or modernizations of the design or anything like that, it really kind of makes it look haunting and lonely and beautiful at the same time. Who haven't we talked about? Try to wrap this up in the next 5-10 minutes.
Oh boy, we haven't talked about Harry and the whole like Hare Krishna.
Yes, Paul makes a return.
Paul comes back.
Which I actually, even though it was a really weird and kind of strange way to bring back an old character, I dislike that tease, if only for the fact that it immediately sparked conversations of, oh, we saw Paul come back. Will we see Sal come back?
Oh, if Sal ever came back, I would shit myself in excitement.
It'll be interesting to see if they ever figure out a way to do that without it just seeming like for nostalgic purposes. But
I have nothing to say. Who's the copywriter, the other copywriter that shared a space with Peggy and Ginsburg?
The artist? Stan?
Stan. I
He's
have not-
basically the new Sal.
Yeah, but I don't have much to say about him other than could he wear tighter pants in every scene.
And shirts,
time.
For that matter.
Yeah.
I actually like him a lot. I wish he became more of a character, because he's an interesting foil, especially now that Peggy's gone. It's clear how much respect he had for her when he's presenting with Ginsburg to Topaz in the finale. I love that scene because it was a classic Mad Men, you know, pitch scene, but it was from two characters that clearly don't like working with each other. And... Stan goes so far as to say, I'm so bored of this dynamic, when he pulls the board down, pun intended, after Topaz declines their idea for the pitch. And Ginsburg's very egotistical and tries to be persuasive, even though he just comes off as petulant. So there's that guy. Who else were we talking about? Harry. Let's talk about Harry for a second. Especially because, like I said, the Rolling Stones scene was one of my favorites, not only because Don had that... admittedly heavy-handed discussion with the teenager.
Right.
But you got that awesome scene with Harry cramming White Castle down his mouth, throat in Don's car, wishing that he'd be able to stay out with Don. It's like the nerd getting to hang out with the cool kid for a night and not wanting to go home early. And Don's just like, I'm going to drop you off.
Plus, Harry's a fox.
Ugh. Well, there's... really?
And he's still a fox.
This is my wife saying this, ladies and gentlemen. After seeing him... screw a Hare Krishna girl doggy style in his office in the middle of the day.
Yeah.
You're still down with the Hare Krishna.
Well, I feel sad for him. Kind of a piteous character, but...
he is. But he's comedic relief.
Huh.
Do you think that they've kind of written him off as a fluff side character since...
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
Like, I thought maybe his character was going to become something bigger... was it season 2 or 3 where he took on television?
The media side, yeah.
And I thought that was going to be a much bigger deal because television was obviously changing the landscape of everything, right?
Right.
Of culture and politics.
Especially during the plot thread of the Kennedy-Nixon debates.
Right,
and, yeah.
Right. I forgot about that whole plot. But, I mean, it really hasn't gone that direction.
No, except for the one big episode he got, which was with the return of Paul, who is a fake Hare Krishna and basically just wants to use Harry to get back into
society.
A regular job, and he tries to hand him a spec script for Star Trek, which I read an interesting blog post about Mad Men this season and all the references to sci-fi. Talk about Ken Cosgrove, that's another character we have yet to mention.
Oh, right.
And that continued that pattern, also the Martian thing with Ginsburg, in that sci-fi is becoming a thing in the late 60s, where people are using it not only as escapist entertainment, but to make a comment on clearly what's going on, the changes and transformations of society during that time period.
Yeah.
I liked Paul's return, even though it was strange and very off-center from the rest of the season, because it felt refreshing. It felt like something different in the kind of going over and over again, whether you call it recycling or whatever. I liked a lot of that, but it was nice to get this kind of random episode that strayed away from the usual.
That's true. And the show needs to take opportunities to introduce a lot of the counterculture stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Into... because they don't have as many opportunities to do that as maybe they did.
It inspired me to read the entire Wikipedia entry of Hare Krishna.
There you go. Interesting.
Something I knew little about before that episode.
But yes, Harry Crane is kind of just the office buffoon now. Oh, yeah. But I enjoy it. He's a hot office buffoon, so it's all right with me.
Gross.
You wanted to talk about Ken Crossgrove a minute, and that just reminded me that there was that scene between him and Roger where he basically...
Oh, yeah. You like that one a lot.
He negotiates, right, to so that he doesn't... they're trying to get business from his father-in-law, and he doesn't want to be involved. And so he negotiates to basically promise Roger that he won't get involved.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I enjoy that scene because that was the episode after... the water cooler episode, right? The other woman episode where Joan basically negotiates a partnership.
Uh-huh.
So apparently a Cooper, what is it?
Sterling Cooper Draper Price. Now they, Sterling Cooper Draper Harris?
I don't know.
No, we'll see.
But they're throwing a, well, but Campbell was already in anyway.
He's silent.
Yeah.
Though.
They're throwing partnerships out like candy at a parade.
Right.
But what's interesting, right, so you have Joan, who negotiates for a partnership.
Yeah.
Something that's really going to push her forward financially, professionally. Then you have Ken, who basically negotiates to screw Pete, because he hates Pete so much.
Yeah.
Right? That all he wants is he wants the glory of being on the account if they get it. Mm-hmm. Right? But he wants Pete to have no part of it.
Right.
He wants Pete to feel snubbed that he's not a part of
his line account. Is something like, I don't... He says, I've got two requirements. One, Pete can't be in this meeting. And two...
and can't be
Pete,
in any meetings.
Pete can't be in any meetings. Which is pretty hilarious. I thought it was interesting that was on the heels of not only the Other Woman episode, but the same episode where Peggy leaves the office.
Right.
And since the beginning of the season, we've gotten this intermittent talk between Ken and Peggy about their quote-unquote pact. That if Peggy was to leave, she promised to bring Ken with her.
Yeah, what a weasel.
And vice versa. And she snubs Ken. And so it's almost as if Ken is snubbing Pete because he's easy to, because he's Pete, he's hateable. and he probably wishes that he could snub Peggy, but he likes her too much to actually do anything bad to her, as if he's in a position of power to do anything like that anyway. All around, I think we can agree that, I mean, we've been able to talk about it for an hour. And
right.
So 16 months later, even though Mad Men many would call uneven, I think Jerkska and I would disagree with that statement. Even if you could call it uneven, it was still enough of a potboiler of a show to keep us interested, keep us excited, and keep us talking.
Yeah, that summed it up quite well.
Thank you. So soon enough, I'm sure you'll be able to find Mad Men Season 5 on DVD if you can catch up before Season 6 starts. As far as I know, there's not going to be this huge hiatus. So it'll likely return in next spring for its penultimate season. And in the meantime, catch up if you haven't been catching up. And hopefully you are okay with spoilers. Mad Men's Season 1 through 3, maybe even 4, are on Netflix. So check out that free trial. And help support Blogulator Radio and Fancy Pants Gangsters in the meantime.
Yay!
You've been listening to Blogulator Radio. Thanks for tuning in. And you can find us, the written version, at theblogulator.com. We're on Facebook, Twitter, at theblogulator, and at Blogulator Radio. You can also find our individual Twitter handles on the sidebar at theblogulator.com. We're at Google Plus as well. Thanks for listening, and per usual,
our opinions are valid.